Welcome to this Day One podcast extra, bringing you an in-depth conversation between our host, Peter Wallace, and a special guest. For more information about Day One or to make a donation, please visit our website at dayone.org.
Welcome to this Day One Podcast Extra. I'm Peter Wallace, and with me today is the Reverend Mark Sargent, Senior Pastor of Embry Hills United Methodist Church in Atlanta, Georgia. Mark is a graduate of Augusta College and earned a Master of Divinity degree from Candor School of Theology at Emory University in Atlanta, and a Master in Psychology from the University of West Georgia. Mark, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Peter.
Now, you're doing a lot of thinking and writing about the Christian faith in the 21st century, including on your new blog at dayone.org. You've introduced some of these concepts on three Day One programs in early 2006. The series was called Into the Brave New World, and we received by far the most requests for transcripts and CDs than any other programs that I can recall. People seem to be hungry for this Christianity that makes sense in their lives and in this world. How would you briefly describe this progressive form of theology? What's different about it?
Well, Peter, in light of the fact that the modern period did actually take place and that we know things in 2009 that people in 1609 and 1409 and 1209 did not know, the chief thing, I think, that distinguishes this Christianity from the brand of Christianities that we have known before is that it seeks to incorporate modern scientific, historical, psychological insights and learnings into the articulation of the Christian faith.
I confess I get frustrated that a large part of the population, and particularly the media, don't seem to realize that there are a lot of followers of Jesus who are spiritually mature and intellectually honest and psychologically savvy, as you've described it. But is this a new phenomenon? Put this into some historical context for us.
There are so many times when I'm watching, I'll mention Bill Maher, for example. Mm-hmm. I do watch his show on a weekly basis, and oftentimes, being the religious satirist that he is, I will want to jump through the television and be able to enter into a conversation with him and just say, wait a minute, there are Christians out here who are not backwards and who are not blind and who do have an education and who do welcome persons of different gender identities and sexual orientations. So it really is sad that we Christians get lampooned and caricatured in a way that really itself represents kind of an unfair stereotype. In many ways, I think the seeds for the kind of unfair stereotyping and caricaturing that goes on were planted in the late years of the 19th century, somewhat in response to Charles Darwin, who tripped up upon some discoveries that were very surprising to him and really world-shaking to a lot of people, but chiefly the ascendancy of modern biblical scholarship, which began to call into question the possibility of understanding the Bible as a literal scientific and historical document. That gave rise to a kind of Christianity that sought to defend against those insights rather than to incorporate them. And of course, it's very difficult to incorporate those insights and begin to reimagine and rearticulate a Christianity that really is lively and smart and kind. I struggle all the time to preach about things like the ascension of Jesus or the experience of Pentecost. I mean, if these are not to be understood literally, how in the world are they to be understood as lively and meaningful spiritual truths? But the beginning of the caricature and the lampooning, I think, traces its origin to the time when Christians, instead of incorporating the insights of modernity, instead felt threatened by them and began to defend against them.
Well, let's talk about some of the practical implications of all this for Christian communities. I know we could talk for hours about this, but help us understand, first of all, the desire to recapture what's been called the life tradition of the faith and leave behind the death tradition, including the concepts of substitutionary atonement of Christ, original sin, and so forth.
I do understand, by the way, that there are there will be hosts of people within Christianity who don't agree with me
sure.
on this, but I find the idea of the substitutionary atonement to be really repugnant. Of course, it's a concept that comes up as a result of the thinking of a man named Anselm, and as you well know, there were lots of other ways of understanding the death of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And part of what we learned with the discovery of the Nag Hammadi documents, for example, is that there were very diverse expressions of Christianity in the early years after the life and death of Jesus, some of which that had nothing at all to do with the death of Jesus. Mm-hmm. We find in the Gospel of Thomas, for example, a great emphasis on Jesus' life and on his teaching and not so much an emphasis on his death. I regard his death as a sad and tragic expression of human rebellion and our desire to shoot and get prophets out of the way rather than to incorporate the very difficult truths that they come along preaching.
Well, as you say, this is very controversial stuff, even in some progressive circles, but it's worth exploring. But the ramifications of this approach can impact our view of the sacraments of the church, for instance. And now you've gone to meddling, but talk about how this might affect how we view the sacrament.
Well, it is controversial, and I do understand that. I live in and practice within that tension so much. I must say that I have ceased in the way in which I practice the sacrament of baptism, for example, in praying over the water that God would bless this water to wash away the sin of the little person or the big person mm-hmm. who's being baptized. And I've rather come to think of baptism as the planting of a really lovely plant in the good soil of loving human community. And for us to grow and bloom like any good plant does, we need water and we need light. And so there are plenty of images that can be very meaningful to us, but you're absolutely right. In my ministry, no longer can I understand baptism as a cleansing away of original sin. Mm-hmm. I just am not able to be there anymore. It certainly has implications for the way that we think of Holy Communion. Mm-hmm. And so in my mind, I've begun to think of Holy Communion as an experience of mutuality and gathering together around the table of the man whom we regard as Lord, whose way of life we find worthy of emulation, a place where we can connect with one another and receive the nourishment that we need for the journey. Nourishment, by the way, that I think we need to be bold and audacious in resisting the kind of injustice and oppression to which I refer in my sermon.
Mark, what are some of the best resources you've come across in helping your own thinking in this area?
I guess I would think of two broad areas of research and inquiry. One would be the significant new work that's being done in what I would call early Christian scholarship. People like Bart Ehrman at Chapel Hill and Elaine Pagels at Princeton, and of course all of the members of the Jesus Seminar, Marcus Borg and John Shelby Spong and the late Robert Funk, they've all been very helpful to me in my understandings, and I would sort of locate that in the arena of Christian scholarship. Or Christian theology. The other area that was very helpful to me is the area of psychology. Mm-hmm. And in the fairly recent degree program I did at West Georgia, in looking into the psychological literature that has to do with religious wounding, and beginning to sharpen my understandings there.
Well, you mentioned in your day one sermon you preached about the concept of religious wounding, and that often is a direct result of narrower theological views, but remind us how those wounds are inflicted in so many people. What happens?
I realize that our time does not permit the deep and broad kind of conversation that you mentioned a while ago could go on for hours. Mm-hmm. But some of the wounds that I have observed and with which I have worked, I think could be fairly easily categorized under the themes of shame and fear and guilt. Mm. So many times, and often this happens in childhood, it's not exclusively reserved for childhood because, as I say in the sermon, any time we are at a new place in our right. life where something really wonderful is trying to find expression, and any time that's squelched or thwarted by what I call faulty religious teaching, a wound can take place. But it is particularly egregious when this wound is inflicted in childhood, when these very tender and wonderful people who are just at the very earliest stages of their human being and becoming run into messages that somehow communicate to them that they're no good, or the thoughts that they are having are no good, or the feelings that they're having are no good, that there's something just significantly impaired about them, that they do have a stain of sin. I'm just thinking that these messages sent to any human being, but especially to human beings who are children, can be deeply, deeply injurious.
Many people, as you've said, have left their religious faith because of these wounds, or they avoid churches or any form of religion. But I'm sure there are some people who simply grin and bear it and stay in their particular traditions, even though they've been wounded. How would you counsel them?
Well, I guess the first thing I would say to them is that we do have to take kind of an inventory of our own thoughts and our own feelings and our own actions. And if we experience anything that we identify as self-limiting or opposed to our what I hope is our constant human unfolding or our constant human blooming, if we identify something that is squelching or thwarting or damaging that, and if we can trace some sort of cause and effect of that squelching to any kind of religious teaching to which we've been subjected or which we've appropriated, then I think that that's the first part. One of the really fascinating things about this topic, Peter, is, of course, if I begin to think courageously about the ways in which my religious upbringing may have been injurious to me, since the people who offered me that upbringing are oftentimes the people who have loved me most dearly and whom I love and to whom I'm very loyal, then the topic of religious wounding can get really complicated because now I'm having to separate the wound from the loving parents or Sunday school teachers or clergy people who inflicted it. So it's really important that we tease apart the wound, that we not assume that the people who inflicted that did so with malicious intent. Oftentimes, as I mentioned in the sermon, the religious wounds that people experience are unwitting. Most people in church don't want to hurt other people. But I think that the beginning place for exploring that wound is to see if there is some place in my own life, in my thought world, in my feeling world, in my behaving world, where I experience some kind of limitation or burden as a result of something that I learned in church.
Oh, I do want to encourage folks who are listening or watching this who have not heard or read your sermon to do that on our website at dayone.org. You gave us a lot of things that we can do with this situation. You encouraged us to articulate a faith that really works in this world, and that's what you're attempting to do. But how can people of faith get in on this conversation in their own churches and circles?
Well, that assumes that the conversation is actually going on in their in their own churches and circles. And so if it's not, then they can be an initiator of that conversation, which is going to accrue to their benefit among some people and earn them the unpopular condemnation of some other people. I think if people wanted to do a Google search of progressive Christianity, there are some groups, outfits, organizations, some of which are highly formalized and some of which are not, that exist in various communities around the country and around the world. I know that we here at Day One are in the process of not only building out the blog content to which you've alluded, but also providing the technological infrastructure whereby people can respond to those, and we can begin to have conversations at the platform of the Day One website. I'd love for people to be directly in touch with me, and we can also find ways to broaden the conversation and involve people who want to be involved. I think it's going to be something that continues long after my lifetime. I just hope I can hang around here as long as possible to be a part of the conversation and to see where in the world this takes us as we continue to take what we regard to be a really authentic way of doing human business, and that is the way that we see lived out in Jesus' life into and beyond the 21st century.
Mark Sargent, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.